On roll call, we're missing Gina, Ken Johnson, and Dan will not be here tonight because of things that have come up for them. And we will go to current business, which is Centennial Committee presentation. Ken.
Mayor Tim, would you come forward, please? Michael Lewis, would you come forward, please? We have a special presentation for the Centennial Committee. First of all, we'd like to thank Michael Lewis for a painting that was, he did. The Othello Centennial was fortunate to have local artist Michael Lewis paint a beautiful painting to be used for advertising for the Centennial. Painting and frame was donated by Northwest Master Artist Michael Lewis to the Centennial Committee. We were originally going to use this as a raffle for proceeds to go to our two scholarships, which were awarded to two 2010 graduating seniors. We were able to donate two scholarships amounting to $3,700 with other fundraising that we did. Mr. Lewis has agreed to donate the painting to the City of Othello to be displayed and to be enjoyed by citizens. We thank Mr. Lewis for the painting and the picture and the framing, and it will be donated to the City of Othello on behalf of the Centennial. So this is what Michael did, and this goes to the City of Othello. Also, the Centennial Committee would like to thank the City of Othello, the entities of the city, and the citizens of Othello for the support throughout the year. Also, special thanks to the Centennial Committee for all their hard work and everything they did all through the last year and a half. Appreciate all that.
Yeah, I'd like to thank them also because I know you guys
have
put a lot of hours in. And I got to enjoy it. My granddaughter to the dancing that one night when we did the speeder rides and took my grandkids to that and everything. And you know, you guys did an awesome job. And I heard a lot of positive comments from the community, and you know, it's just been really special, this Centennial and painting done for us. And you know, just for the city, I'd like to say thank you again to everybody and even all volunteers in the community, because without you, you know, volunteers don't make our community what it is. You know, the benefits we get to enjoy here. So thank you again for all your hard work and a very successful Centennial. Ken, thank you. And
thank you. Leader.
Sure.
I want to say something to Michael here. The reason we decided to do that is to raffle it off one person to have the honor of this and be gone. This way, the citizens will follow the guy forever. So that's why we decided to do this.
Great. I was glad to go.
Also, the Centennial Committee would like to make a couple of special presentations. One goes to the Othello, the old hotel, for special for their support and contribution to the Centennial year. And I was hoping somebody here from the Othello old hotel would be here, but if not, I'm going to give this to Eric, trust you.
I'm on the board.
Anyway, here's a check for $500 for the Centennial Committee for all the work that they did. We appreciate what they did for us. Mm-hmm. And just to be on the good side, we will present you with a flag.
Thank you.
Also, the Othello Community Museum, I think they did a great job of supporting us and involvement. And with their open house that they had at the museum, theater play that they put on prior to our event. I thought it was very, very thoughtful, and I think you did a great job on that. And we would like to pursue them with a $500 check.
Centennial Committee, Othello Homeless Committee presentation, Alan Hanks. I'd also like to say congratulations to Alan. He's retiring at the end of this year. That's from, yeah, for all the awesome things you've done in this community, we say thank you.
Hell is my town. I was raised here. It's been a pleasure. You guys, I understand, want a little update of what's going on with homelessness and the community. I'm not sure how involved you've been and what you know about it up to today. So I'll give you just a quick history. In 2005, somewhere in that neighborhood, the state decided that one of their goals was to reduce homelessness by 50% in the state. And of course, they did what they always do, is that they went to the cities and the counties and told them to do it, and gave us some guidelines. And one of the things that we do is a homeless count every year, which I'm going to invite you all to before we're done tonight, so if I forget. And the state did something else. In this movement to help prevent homelessness and to provide emergency shelters to folks, is they actually came up with some money, which is kind of a rare thing. There's some increases in filing fees with county auditor's office, and I think most of them increased $5 and maybe some of them 10 for filing, and that started a bank account that the counties keep part of the money, and part of it goes to the state to pool for big projects that are going on. Adams County takes in about $50,000 a year in our homeless fund. We've got a couple of different funds. And what we've done, and then the state at the same time gave some grant monies that up until this last year, we're totaling about $35,000 a year that we could use to prevent homelessness and to maybe put people in emergency shelters, hotels, that kind of thing on a short-term basis. And of course, nothing's new. That's not a new concept at all. We've been putting people in motels and shelters as long as I can remember. Back in my early days in public life, we put people in jails, called them sleepers. We don't get to do that everywhere.
Sleepers.
It was a great place. It probably is a lot cheaper than other things. And we've been doing it for a long time. This last year, the first 2 years of the program, the Housing Authority administered the grant monies, and say we had about $35,000-$40,000, and we banked, we took care of the money, we funded the local emergency aid. There was funds available for in Ritzville, because it's a countywide thing, and we helped probably 200-250 people that first couple of years. Not a lot of money, we were doing rent stuff as low as $50 sometimes, and sometimes $400-$500, depending on what the case may be. At the end of the first 2 years, there was some stimulus money came in a year and a half ago, and it was to the deal that they didn't really, we were told we couldn't, the Housing Authority couldn't administer that money. So the logical thing was to go to Adams County. The community network was suffering from budget cuts and that, and they've been handling this money for the last year and a half. We've they have dispersed funds to about 230 people somewhere in the last year. I think that maybe that money is going to go back to the Housing Authority because of some orphanage cuts that they're going through. So I wouldn't be surprised if my successor didn't get to be in the Housing Authority. Tickles the heck out of me. At the same time, about 3 years ago, Adams County, out of this money that has been going into the bank account, leased three houses from the Housing Authority. They're kind of scattered around town, and they're solely for the use of emergency shelters. The domestic violence can use them, the CPHA can use them, the emergency aid can use them, and we've put about 130 people in those houses just in the, so far this year. For about 900 bed days. And it's real cheap. It's costing just a little over $5 a day per person to put them in. So it's been a real boon. So you can see there's really quite a little bit going on. And I think it's only going to be bigger. There's going to be more and more as it goes on. And particularly as our population increases. On the 26th? On the 27th of January, we'll have about our fifth annual homeless count, where we team up, we go all over the county and all the places in the typically outside the community to count homeless folks. And you're all cordially invited. It's all volunteer. People take an afternoon out of their life. We'll team you up with some folks that have done it before. And if you think you know Othello, come out with us and we'll show you the rest of the story. You can see how some folks are living in homeless camp. I think we had 230 homeless before, 270 homeless people last year. Last year, I think it was pretty nice weather, and maybe there weren't as many as a pretty, real cold year where people aren't working and everybody's stuck at home, the count goes higher. If it's a nice day and folks are out working, then it's a little lower because it's a one-day, point-in-time count.
Any questions for Alan?
So Alan, that's the quick version about 5 years ago.
We don't see the typical homeless situation in town, people in cardboard boxes and laying in front of storefronts. Have we cured it, or they just move outside of town,
no,
or is it?
If you look hard enough, you're going to see folks sleeping in parks, and you're going to see folks on the outskirts of town. The people living in cars. Another typical homeless person is a one bedroom or a one room place with two or three families living in it, where we've got terribly crowded conditions. Or we've got a lot of people that are surfing from one place to the other. We've got a lot of places that don't have adequate heat or running water, and that meets the definition of homeless.
What are the criteria for homelessness?
Not having sanitary conditions, water, sewer, hot water, and not being able to heat a house above, I think, 65 degrees, and not having a permanent place to live. If we've got multiple people living in a house, we can count some of them as homeless.
So you're figuring we have over 200 in Othello?
I'm figuring we probably have closer to 500 in Othello, but we've never been able to count more than about 270 or 280. It's a one-day count. We do it the last Thursday in January. And you lose a lot of people that aren't even here than if they can be someplace else. If we counted homeless in the better weather, it would probably be a lot higher.
You say in Othello, but you mean the Othello area?
We're talking actually Adams County.
Okay, there you go.
I'm thinking, when I say Othello, I'm thinking the surrounding area. So we count, there's places inside the city limits of Othello where we count and find homeless people every year. The parks they're living in are Pioneer Park and Lions Park.
Right. Any questions? Well, thank you, Alan, and congratulations on your retirement. Yeah, it sounds interesting. Okay, community garden project, Tim Taft, Pastor Tim.
I'd like to do about three things with the community garden. First, let you know that we have one.
and how it started. And to begin that, it's a kind of a conglomeration, cooperation between four or five entities. And so it started with Washington State University and the Extension Agent Master Gardener Program. And the person who helped us start that is here tonight. So I'd like to introduce Eric Lampe from Washington State University Master Gardener Program. He'll give us the introduction to it, and it should be four or five slides, and kind of the vision. We'll talk about what we have now, and then we'll talk about the future and what we'd like to do with it. Eric.
Thank you for having me here tonight. You guys can just forward the mic. Okay, no worries. Okay. There you go. Okay. I've had the opportunity to work as the WSU Grant Adams Area Master Gardener Program Coordinator for 4 years now. October would be the start of my fifth year. And so after a year of learning all of the options of what I could do with my job, in the last 2 years I started thinking about what I can do that's going to make a difference for my service area. And one of the things that I noticed when I was going to grocery stores is I would see people with grocery carts, and I'm a little bit curious, so I would watch and see what's in the grocery carts and how they're paying. And what I noticed a lot of was that the grocery carts that were being paid for with EBT cards didn't necessarily have anything I would call food in them. Okay, here's a shopping cart, and just from a first glance, it looks like it might be okay. You know, it looks like it's got some food in there. Well, what it has is an awful lot of simple carbohydrates and sugary juice and more simple carbohydrates and a bag of apples. And if you are living at poverty level and using an EBT card, this is the only food in that basket. The rest of it is empty calories. So I thought to myself, what can I do? And I know from research that children who grow their own food are more likely to eat fresh fruits and vegetables or express a preference for those foods. And I had the opportunity to write a grant and start a school community garden in George Elementary. So that school has been running for 2 years now. The first summer, because they have a summer program for their kids, we had a salad bar that the kids went out to their own garden that they've been tending, and they harvested their vegetables, and they had salad for lunch that day. We only got to do it once because summer school got out, but the garden was still there in the fall. This year with the community garden in George, the first harvest of broccoli took 100 pounds to the food bank. That garden fed four families, and when school started up again this fall, the fourth graders are in charge of it. Fourth grade teacher lets them out just a little early for lunch so they can go out to the garden and get fresh produce to eat with their lunch. And they send produce home with every kid after school. So I have this personal vision of what a community garden should look like, and it's got three parts to it. It should be a place for individuals or families to grow produce to improve their diets and lower their household food costs. It should be a place for community volunteers to grow produce for those who can't and donate it to local food banks. And ideally, teachers at various levels from K through 12 would want to involve their students with hands-on experiences in math, science, writing, and nutrition. We started the garden this year also in Royal City. And I have the second grade teacher and the seventh grade teacher both making use of their garden in their curriculum. I'm still waiting for someone here because the location is right behind the farm. So that would be a really good thing. Okay, in Othello, you have the population that could use the garden, and you have property, and you have water, and you have volunteers, and you have space.
That is our space button. Yeah. Might go back one bit.
Yeah.
Well, back.
That is really us.
Can you go back?
This right here is really where we.
Okay. This right here is what we started with. This is what the community garden started with when Eric and I first started. Those of you on that side.
This is your community garden spot on day one.
Now, just to get a reference point, your back would be against the scoreboard at McFarland Junior High. You're looking south.
Scoreboard. Oh, that's the walk path. You see it right there?
So, Othello. You know, when you look on the internet and you're trying to find some icon that's Othello, you either get the airplane or the water tower.
Yep.
So I would look at the water tower. Okay, you have the target populations, you have property with water, you have a long-term commitment from your property owner, you have volunteers, and you have a community garden.
That is our community garden.
This is your community garden about midsummer, with a few more people who have adopted it. So the view for the future now. The commissioners in Grant County have fixed a budget, and it doesn't include me. So your garden is yours now. Part of the view for the future, I've been working with the health departments, and the garden is part of their Healthy Communities program. And you should take that and run with it. You need to let people know that your garden is there and it's available for them. And if we run out of room, we have more. Okay, right now there's irrigation installed for 21 garden plots on a timer. Mm-hmm. So all you've got to do is go pull weeds and pick vegetables. It's painless. But we particularly want to hit people who are in apartments and don't have a chance to garden, or people whose income is to the point where they can't afford to water. I have a garden in my backyard, and I have city water in Moses Lake, and I have $20 tomatoes because my water is expensive. This water is paid for. Okay. Okay, so your current partnerships, you have me for another 3 weeks, but...
in the snow.
Yeah. Where were those homeless places? Okay, we've got Adams County Health Department, we've got Juvenile Extension, Walmart, the Othello Store, Ace Hardware, Dell's Lab, the Job Corps built your garden shed. Have you seen your garden shed?
No, I
haven't. You have an 8x12 garden shed. Materials were not donated, but seriously discounted by Ziggy's. And then the shed was built by Job Corps. And then ProBuild has also helped contribute to your garden. Okay, current programs that are involved with this: Healthy Communities, Diabetes Education, Nutrition and Diet, and the Food Bank. And I just learned at our Healthy Communities meeting last week that if you donate a pound of food to the Food Bank, the government kicks in like $1?
$1.50.
$1.50.
Yeah.
You ought to be making use of that community garden. Okay, we have some individuals who provided us with an awful lot of help. Mm-hmm. And names here: Matt Hampton, Bob Carlson, Tracy and Dulcie Fields, Forestwood Farms, Juvenile Detention, and the entire Othello community.
And we just make note, these guys, how they contributed. Matt did some Disney course, Bob got the water installed, Tracy and Dulcie helped put the water timer on it. We've dug an irrigation system. You can see part of it right here. These are the spouts that come up. There's 21 plots all over it. This the land itself is owned by the Nazarene Church. We have to pay the water on it anyway, so we're donating the land and the water. This land will never be used by our development because there's a 96-foot wide green space between our property and the development that's just to the east of us. So theoretically, this could run twice the depth of it is right now. And one of the things we learned, I didn't realize at the health community, that means the donation is not just canned goods, that's fresh produce will be matched as well. So that has a lot of potential. One of the part that I'm thrilled about, written up in a national magazine for, was working with JDAI and their ideas, a juvenile detention alternative initiatives. And so what happens in that program is that we have juveniles that
that have issues, obviously, but they don't need to go to jail to learn how to be better juvenile people. We would like them to input into the community and have consequences for their actions, but positive consequences. And so, alas, Martinez took on that role. And what they did was they got their own plots, and they brought kids to go out and picture the glass, picking up the plants and things at Walmart. He went to Dell's, got some of the fencing they used for trellises. They planted the garden, they weeded it, they took it to the food bank, and they helped donate over 200 pounds to the food bank.
Wow.
So that's not only 200 pounds, that's 200 or $300 as well, because we got a matching on it. So you got your buck and a half match, which is a great opportunity. And that's just these little plots right here. I think we had 8 plots total out of 21 going. Now, some other things that have happened since then is Laz and his program, and with some cooperation, we have half of the wood we need to make these all raised beds next year. So what we'd like to have is 21 groups of raised beds and people applying to have those plots themselves. Mike, can you go to the next one? We have here's an idea. The progress, here's what we started with again. And here's where we were in the summer, and then this is the new shed that just got arrived at the end of the growing season. Michael, one more. We have an application here as well. So what we did was developed, this is last year's application. The theory would be that people would have, the applications would be at lots of public places where people could pick them up that may need the space or not be able to afford the water to do it. And then they would apply for a plot. We'd be responsible for the entire weeding and produce production of that plot, and then all the water would be provided for them on a timer, and they'd be able to grow the produce for them. So that's, and we obviously like to expand it as far as people being involved. And again, we can't thank Tracy and Bob enough to make it happen. Because those are the kinds of things that you don't know it's there, then all of a sudden with some extra volunteer help, it's rolling. And Eric happened to be mentioning what we're doing with JDAI to some of the Master Garden programs. And this is out of this is amazing, out of Atlanta, at Royal Cup, just because it was so unique to take juveniles, and it's kind of Laz's brainchild in JDAI's, and use those kids back into your community and having them invest. And we've seen changes in kids because the questions that he gets to talk with them about growing and the pride that they get in raising something and then they take it to the food bank is a win-win all the way around. So we're really excited about the future of it. So we hope to fill the garden up this next year, and then we want to triple or quadruple what we donate to the food bank next year. So any questions?
So basically you just fill out that paper in there.
We'll update this. What we don't want, personally, because of the landowner, we don't want to be a Nazarene church thing. We want it to be, we're donating the land and the water to it. And there's a cooperative between the healthy communities and other people. So what we're really looking for, and I've discussed this with the city, but we're still looking for a fiscal agent where we can run it, rather than creating a whole new 501c3 just for this. It'd be nice to just have a fiscal agent where we could have an in and out budget. And the money, have people that like $15 for a plot. So the money would be used to keep the irrigation system updated and maybe improvements. I know Tracy wants to see a nice picket fence all the way around it. He let me away with this donated fence place, but he wants a real nice.
Tim and I spent lots of hours in the hot sun putting that fence.
Yes, we did. But it's not real straight.
And we had some very good spiritual growth going on.
So
that was going to be my question. Was there a cost? So it sounds like you're looking at something.
And the reason behind the cost is it's been my experience that if there's no cost experience-wise or expense, there's no responsibility. So that's what you want to put the bar just high enough where people have to put a little effort to be able to have a plot. They're responsible for it. And then if, worst case scenario, they abandon it, we could have it cleaned up or either pay somebody to do it or donate it to JDAI. And then it perpetuates, and then the sprinkler systems don't run down either. They need to be replaced or deteriorate the sun. They can be replaced without a big expense to the organization as a whole. So. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. This sounds like a great opportunity for the citizens. So, okay. Walk path discussion. Daryl.
Thank you, Mayor, members of the council. Good evening. This issue is coming for you for consideration, or at least discussion, because there were modifications made to the walk path as a result of construction which took place at McFarland Middle School. And we have a drawing that we've been using in our conversations working with the fellow school district representatives, as well as representatives from the Nazarene Church, which is the adjacent property owner to the walk path. And those relationships, I think, will come into play a little bit more as we go through this discussion and presentation. But what we basically have is that the city has acquired an easement through the school property. And the easement is identified in this drawing at this location, wraps around the athletic fields, and the easement continues straight and comes out to 10th Avenue, or 10th Street. The modifications that took place as part of the school construction actually eliminated the walk path at this location and took it across this emergency access aisle over to a sidewalk that was created as part of the development and then continues on. There are a couple problems with that route currently. One is that in this location on the west side of 10th, that currently is not an ADA access. And so as you come across the walk path, you have ADA accessibility on the east side, but you come across the street and there's no ADA accessibility on the west side. Whereas before, the path went straight across at this location where there is ADA access on both sides of the street. So that's one issue that we're dealing with in terms of how to deal with this new modification that took place as part of the construction. The other is that since the city does have a recorded easement here, if there were to be any modifications to the walk path, there should have been a presentation before the city council to modify that recorded easement. It's not a right-of-way. I've heard some conversations that the city has a right-of-way at this location, and that isn't the case. It's an easement that was granted by the school district. But nevertheless, the city does have certain rights associated with that easement in developing that walk path and the locations that are identified within that easement. So for that walk path to be relocated, there should have been some community discussion that came before the city council that actually authorized a modification to the easement and the city council agreeing to a relocated walk path. And unfortunately, back several years ago, that did not take place. And in fact, it's the school district's position that a representative of the city at that time, working with them through that construction program, gave his authorization to relocation, but did not have the authority to act on behalf of the city in order to do that. So the dilemma we have at this point is we have a relocated path with no authority from the city council to modify the easement that does exist legally allowing for that path. Now, one other issue that I think is important to know is that this property to the south is owned by the Nazarene Church. And you just heard the presentation on the community garden, which is located about in this position, give or take a few feet. But it's located off the walk path to the south of that walking path. And that, as you heard, that's the permanent location that's intended for that community garden. But there is a proposed development for the church property to where they would build a new sanctuary, a church building at this location south of the school. And their plan is to actually share this drive aisle that currently exists, duplicate that on the south side, and create a parking area that would be utilized by both the church and the city. And you can see that there would certainly be a conflict if we were to maintain this easement and were to force the issue of the walk path going back at that location. The church and the school district could not go forward with their joint venture plans to develop this parking area that would be used by both the school district for overflow at events and then by the church during their services and their needs. So, in discussions with the school district and with the Nazarene Church representatives, we looked at what options might be available in terms of utilizing the walk path that has been created
and how that could best serve the community in terms of providing safe, accessible routes with the least amount of interruption to the users of that walk path. And actually, as we look at this, with this crossing here, it begins to create a very safe separation between the emergency route and any vehicular use that might take place there, because people are used to using crosswalks, and this is currently marked at this location, and there is ADA accessibility on the sidewalk at this point and at this location on the walk path. The school district has offered and has indicated they would provide modifications to the sidewalk on the west side of 10th to create an accessible route onto the sidewalk at this location, and then they have also indicated they would provide adequate signage to direct people in the proper locations to utilize the walk path. If the walk path were then to be developed and allowed to be maintained in its current configuration with improved accessibility and improved signage, then the church and the school district could move forward with their plans to share a joint access point as well as a joint use parking lot through agreements between the school district and the Nazarene Church. So that's what's been proposed by the property owners that are involved in this process, but it will require action by the city council to formally modify the easement that currently exists, because you do have legal rights to utilize this easement should you choose to do that. But in doing so, it would require the removal of a fairly substantial level of improvements that were placed by the school district, both in terms of pavement and sidewalk, and it would preclude the long-range plans for these two properties to have the joint-use parking lot and joint access point off of 10. Yeah, we do have a larger drawing, and unfortunately we don't have this in electronic form to be able to put it up on the screen. But let me get my bearings. They're showing it as an alley at this location. And maybe I can get you to place it. This is McFarland School at the top of the page. 10th located here. This is currently that fire lane and the walk path in the right side here, coming over to the sidewalk and across the school property. This is where the easement is currently located, on the very north side of that property boundary. And as you can see, what the proposal is to extend the drive aisle in this area, create parking stalls off of that drive aisle, and these would be utilized by the church, and then there would be a joint agreement between the church and the school district for overflow parking for school events. That's the current plan for development of that site to the south. But if the walkway were to continue down that easement, it would preclude that joint use from happening and would require pretty extensive modification of this plan and substantially reduce the amount of available parking.
So the only issue is a 6-foot walking path there. They can't scooch everything 6 feet to the south.
It has to do with easements and distance.
The easement is a 10-foot wide easement, and unfortunately, if you were to put a 10-foot easement or walk path down the center of this, you would not be able to have appropriately sized drive aisle to be able to serve this parking. You would have parking backing into the walk path, which you wouldn't want. There would not be sufficient room there for that. And the school district would have to do some fairly substantial removal of improvements in order to satisfy their emergency access requirements for their school.
Well, two things. One, I don't understand what overflow parking has to do with it, because they can park at the school and walk over to the church and vice versa, walk across the walking path. I don't understand why the church can't move everything 6 feet to the south.
Well, it's farther than 6 feet, because the church parking would actually utilize not only their 10 feet on this side, but they would utilize the 30 feet on the other side, so that you'd have a 40-foot drive aisle. And that's the key to this, is that you have 40 feet of drive aisle available under this joint plan, if you were to put a walk path down the center of that, the church no longer has sufficient maneuvering space to accommodate this parking in this location. So it would disrupt the relationship between the two sites.
Why can't they come off 10th to their parking lot?
Well, they could. But again, they would lose a number of parking spaces. They would lose the ability to share this access point with the school district. They would have to increase the amount of pavement for their access point, thereby increasing their cost. And it would preclude the shared use of that.
So they want to allow traffic to go east on an emergency fire lane so they can come into the parking lot?
This would be a 40-foot wide area that would be utilized for access to the parking lot, exit from the school, and still maintain its ability to be an emergency access route, yes.
So they'd have to make that lane wider?
Yes, yeah, so that would have to be wider.
Because it's already got curbing on the south side, so you have to knock out all that curbing.
The curbing would come up as part of this development plan. But again, I think the important issue here is the location of the walking path in relationship to how it's been relocated. And is that something that the city wants to pursue in terms of approving the revised location, or does the city want to force the easement that currently exists and require the school district to remove a substantial investment of improvements that took place at that site?
So the easement didn't extend onto the property, the church property at all?
No, the easement ends at the property boundary.
Which is the curb.
Yes. The easement was granted by the school district, not by the church.
Can I address that, Mark?
Pardon?
I was just asking if I can add on that a little bit. One of the thoughts was that we would both, the school and the church, would give up 10 or 15 feet of property to have that easement, you know, to both use that lane. But with this curb right here and the walking path, we'd leave it in existence. The curb there and the walking path, we'd probably need to add another curb, you know, so that people are safe inside that walking path while they're walking, you think. If you did that, then you have to add, I think, another 10 or 20 feet, 10 or 30 feet, to have another road that would come in here to serve these parking lots, right, parking spots. So you're going to lose all those parking spots that would be right here for another access. You wouldn't be able to have that back. So that's the thinking behind it. That the school has agreed to take that curb out, and then they could use those same spots there because there's not enough distance between the back of the building and here to have you'd probably cut probably 60-70% of those parking spots out. That's kind of the thinking.
So I assume your blueprints there are showing as far south as your property allows.
Yes.
Yes. Future road there.
For the size of the sanctuary. You have to have so many parking spots for the size of the sanctuary.
And you can't move everything south at all?
It would be the same issue, because if you move them south, then you lose these parking spots on both sides, on the side here. Because it's not just a 6 foot, it's more than the width of the path, because we have to have driving easements to have access back here. This wouldn't be here at all. So all these parking spots
would
go away.
Oh, I see. Scoot is there. Okay, that's true.
Yeah. So all this would go away, because all you have is kind of a parallel park right here to be able to have.
So you're proposing they would drive in here.
We would share with the school.
Right.
That access would be both of them.
And then you pull in your parking lot here? Or where would you pull in? Where are you pulling into your parking lot?
This is not necessarily a curb. This isn't a curb. It's just showing the shared distance between the two of us. So these would be hidden this way. And there's a 30-foot distance for them to back out and use this for access. Exiting. Yeah. And the idea would be then that would be shared.
I thought this is currently all one way heading west.
It is, but the idea would be you would add to that lane so you would have one lane coming in east. They could park, they could back out, and then use the lane heading west. So basically, we create a two-way lane of traffic where currently there's only one way under that proposal. The other complication at this point is if the church were to set up a separate access point, there's separation requirements for access from property to property. And because the school has this right on the property line, it would affect the distance without a variance to where that access point could be. And that's done for safety purposes. You don't want conflicting car movements in two separate access points coming off within a very short distance. That does not create for a safe environment. It would be particularly concerning in terms of safety if you were to have a walk path going right to the center of that. That could be proved to be very difficult. So I think what you would find is that the church actually would need to do some major modifications to their site plan in order to accommodate the safety elements built into your code of where that access point would be allowed if they don't do this joint approach with the school district.
Well, but traffic coming out of the parking lot and heading east and going around the gym where McFarland is on the east side, they'll have to come to a abrupt halt because I don't think there's enough lanes to accommodate going. You'd be good, gets your arrows there.
Well, this drive aisle currently is an emergency access point, and I believe they also use it for buses.
Right.
Currently.
But it's all one way.
But you would have another lane at this point that would go to this, about this distance, equally as wide. That would be your easterly route. They would back go into parking spaces, they would back out, and then come west on the other aisle. It would be just like a roadway. You'd be backing into a roadway that would be wide enough to accommodate two lanes of traffic.
Well, if they got confused, though, and wanted to go out the other way, what's stopping them?
I would anticipate that there's currently a gate here. That gate would be relocated here. So they couldn't be confused. There would be only one way out.
Well, I mean, the downside is we're sending our walking path across a bus route and an emergency route.
Yeah, and I guess the good news about that is that this does not generate a substantial amount of traffic throughout the day. It's only very select periods of time when there is bus activity. There's also a lot of activity taking place in this location during that period of the day with children getting prepared to board the buses. But the only time that you have traffic through the site is when there's either drop-off or pickup, and those are scheduled throughout the day. It isn't a constant flow of traffic through that, and that adds to the safety of that crossing by not having general vehicular traffic utilizing that route on a continuous basis. And of course, there's usually no activity there on the weekends unless there happens an emergency that the vehicles need to use for the sports field or something like that. So in terms of the crossing here, it's highly visible, there's good sight distance, it's well marked, and it is ADA accessible. And what that does is then gets the pedestrians up to a raised curb onto a regular sidewalk where, again, they have separation from the traffic flow that takes place. The only real obstacle to that path is, again, lack of an ADA accessible approach right here on the sidewalk on the west side of 10th.
How wide is that sidewalk?
This sidewalk here?
Yeah. No, the one going along the emergency.
The new one, I believe that's 8 feet. It's a very nice, modern, wide sidewalk. This sidewalk here may not be a full 8 feet, and that may need to be widened, and that's something I think in our discussions with the school district, they would make those improvements that would make it consistent with the remainder of the walk.
So just so I'm clear on this, we had a written easement with the school district to put that walking path in, and they had nothing in writing that they could change that easement or destroy the walking path that was there.
Well, the only body that could grant authorization to modify that easement once it was executed was be the city council. And to the best of my knowledge, there's nothing in the record that would indicate that ever came before council or the school district to modify that easement. Although the school district believes they went forward with what they thought was appropriate authorization from a city official to do that.
But there is an easement on record,
yes.
i.e. in writing.
Yes, and that easement goes right through here where that dotted line is located.
Sir? Looking at that, making that crosswalk across their driveway, it's basically no different going across a regular street anyway, with less traffic most of the time during the day. And then you've got the other one that goes across with the ADA. And to me, that looks like the logical way, whether, rather than getting involved and people trying to change everything when they're trying to plant their land and make it fit what they're trying to do. As long as it works and you've got the flow through there, it looks to me like that's the right way to go. You may have to do a little revision on the easement to get that portion of it through there to make that work. But it looks like a simple solution.
Well, in looking at the options that were on the table in conversations with the school district and with the church, I think we came to that same conclusion as well, that this appeared to be the most practical solution and the solution that provided the safest route for the pedestrians, both in terms of this crossing and improvements to the sidewalk over here. We had a real concern if we were to continue to move traffic down this easement location, there would need to be a barrier between the travel lane and this walkway. And because of the curve, that just a simple curve may not have been sufficient. It may have needed to be higher or use some delineators of some sort to make that safer. Getting those folks up on the sidewalk out of the curb radius really is a safer route from a pedestrian standpoint.
So the school is ready to give us a new easement, what you're showing us?
Again, we would need to modify the easement. The school appears to be amenable to do that. As part of the easement modification, the school would make the necessary improvements to the ADA facility on the west side, as well as the sidewalk if it was insufficient in terms of width or if it was in disrepair. There's also areas in this part of the path that have deteriorated over the years. It appears as though that deterioration is not new. It does not appear to be part of the construction activity that took place at the school. Nevertheless, the school district has indicated that if the city were to identify those areas, they'd also do those repairs to that area of the walkway. So the school district appears to be willing to make the modifications necessary to the easement and do those safety improvements that are necessary to create a very safe area for this location of the walk path.
As well as relocating the gate.
Yeah, as well, when the time comes to coordinate this with the church property, the gate would be then located as well.
Wouldn't it make sense to locate that gate on the west side of the walk path?
Yeah.
So if somebody started going the wrong way, they couldn't get to that crosswalk?
You're thinking...
No, just right here. Right
yeah,
here.
Just right. Right no, just on the other side of it,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, right there, where Mike is.
Oh, we can certainly
yeah, that would make sense to me.
It would be relocated anyway once the joint development took place, and so I'm not sure that the school district would have any objection to that. We could certainly check with them to make sure.
Well, here, one, that path that you talked about, they would repair damaged stuff. I mean, we have eyewitness that says during construction, trucks and vehicles went down that walking path.
I have no doubt that they did that. What we have been able to, not, we have not been able to determine that specifically created any of the damage. But some of the damage that is located on that walk path clearly has been there for a number of years. It's slowly deteriorated. But the school district has said they would be willing to look at those areas and do those improvements and maintenance and repairs that would be necessary to bring that back up to a newer condition.
How about just redo it for us? Second, you say at the end of the walking path, which is coming to your little, yeah, right there, which is asphalt, is ADA compliant. Is it just the end of the asphalt?
It's at grade with the new paving at this location. So there's no ramp at all. It simply is built at grade. And then on this side, there's the standard ADA ramp leading up to the raised curb and sidewalk.
And that's already there?
That's in place, yes. As is the markings for the crosswalk.
Ken, you have another question?
No.
Oh, you were raising your fingers. I thought you had some. Yeah.
If the school district is willing to do it, we better get on the bed out there.
Continue to work with the school district and bring back to council consideration a revised easement that would reflect that location and ensure that within that easement there were the appropriate guarantees by the school district to do those improvements that we discussed this evening?
That, I'm not happy about this, but it's probably the best alternative. But my thing would be they overlay that walking path where they drove on it. They have signs up that says walking path, the formal walking path is this way, and now it's this way, and you go back this way. And that when you make the ADA compliant on 10th there on the west side, that they do make that sidewalk wider than 5 feet. And if they agree to that, you know,
I will say that they have offered all of those elements except for a complete overlay of the existing path through this entire location. They have agreed to look at those areas that have deteriorated and are willing to repair those to a likely condition.
That's pretty subjective. I don't know how you determine that, but.
Okay, thank you, Darrell.
Excuse me, Mr. Mayor.
Yeah.
Fire department would like to comment on the
okay.
Fire access there. After some review, we've just now learned of that proposal.
And that review will come as part of the overall development on the church property. This will not be modified until this comes forward with your development plan. So that would be the appropriate time to take hold of that review.
Okay.
Do you foresee problems with this? Chief Liebachen, or?
I would like to review it.
Okay.
Great. Okay, thanks, Chief.
What's the timetable on this now?
Well, we would need to create the revised easement and have that developed and bring it back to council. We initially thought we might be able to accomplish that by your next meeting. I think more appropriately, it would probably be two meetings away. If you hold a meeting, your second meeting, December, we can have it back to you then. If not, we would have the easement prepared and have it for you in the first meeting in January.
Yeah, I don't think I'd rather do it right. I don't think there's a lot of people out walking around now anyway, so I don't think it's a big time issue. But
and then with spring approaching, at that point, the school district would be able to make the necessary improvements.
Would the easement say we're willing to move it or adjust the easement based on these conditions? Is that how it reads out?
The agreement would be a modification to the easement that would specify and outline the requirements of that modification, yes.
Okay.
Which should be brought to the council,
yes,
to read.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay, Planning Commission's recommendation related to accessory structures.
Thank you. You may recall several months ago now, it was actually back in the summer months, we brought to the council the issue of accessory structures, and the concern that had been raised by some in the community in regards to their overall size, the footprint, both in terms of size and also the height, and then the exterior materials that would be utilized in some of these accessory structures. And when we say accessory structures, we're primarily looking at things such as garages, because that seems to be what gets the most attention and tend to be built the largest. So we brought some examples to the council as to how other communities have been addressing the accessory structures and what regulations some communities are putting in place in regards to these and trying to bring them more in line with the residential character of the communities that they're located in. At that time, the council requested that the matter be sent to the Planning Commission for review. That was done. The Planning Commission considered this issue over several meetings and have now prepared to bring forward to the full council a recommendation in regards to how accessory uses should be regulated. We wanted to bring this to you this evening just for information. We do intend to bring this back to the council at your meeting on the 13th to consider it for action if you're prepared to do so at that time. We also have the chairman of the Planning Commission here this evening, and I'm sure we'd be happy to respond to any questions or issues or clarifications that you might have in regards to how the Planning Commission was thinking in terms of preparing the recommendation. But I think I can summarize the Planning Commission's discussions and comments pretty succinctly. I think the Planning Commission felt, in speaking on their behalf, that they recognized that there was a need to somehow get a handle on these accessory structures to ensure that they continue to be work compatible with residential neighborhoods. I think they also saw that there was certainly some trend that accessory structures were getting larger, that they were being built out of materials that perhaps weren't conducive to residential neighborhoods, such as metal siding, aluminum metal siding. I think they also saw that, there was a need to characterize accessory structures to fit a residential neighborhood in terms of their appearance, both in terms of overall size and in the types of siding materials that would be used. So in looking at those things, they developed a set of criteria and recommendations in terms of regulations for these accessory structures. First and foremost, they wanted to make sure that people could have a small accessory structure without it being a very difficult task to do. So if you wanted to go down to the local hardware store and purchase a pre-made kit or build your own, that fell under the threshold of requiring a building permit, which currently is 120 square feet of roof area, that should be allowed. And you still need to meet setback requirements, that's in our code already, but if you know, the material that those are made out of sometimes are metal. If you go to Sears or some other place, you can buy those metal sheds. Or you can buy wood siding that may or may not be similar to the siding you can find in your house. And they wanted to leave that option available for folks without having to go through a great deal of regulation in order to place those. So those are excluded from their regulations that they're proposing. With that said, there's one clarification in the handout that I wanted to make because it was a change that actually should have been made that was not, and that's in it's identified as 5, it's now item 4, and on item 4A, the last portion of that sentence, 900 square feet, should be eliminated. So you can find it right here. The Planning Commission wanted to not have the overall size, the footprint of all accessory structures exceed the overall square footage of the primary residence. And they thought the 900 foot requirement, which was a part of the original example, was overly restrictive. And so they felt that as long as you did not have anything larger than the footprint of your house, that would be acceptable in keeping with the residential neighborhood. The 45% of the lot may not be covered, more than 45% of the lot covered by buildings. The roof pitch should be 312, which is kind of standard for our residential structure. And the exterior siding and roofing material should be of similar appearance and color to that of the principal legal use. So if your house is lap siding, the accessory structure, if it's over 120 square feet, should be lap siding. If it's board and bath, that's the appearance of the accessory structure. In other words, the accessory structure mimics the appearance and overall materials of the primary residence. And then there's a separation within the building code that's met within these regulations of 5 feet. And there's also setback requirements that are already contained within our code that the Planning Commission felt the accessory structure should meet. There initially was, again, a proposal in the examples that were provided that had accessory structures no closer to the street than the primary residence. And through the discussion of the Planning Commission, they modified that to simply meet the front yard setbacks. And the thought was is that there are residences that have garages out front and they're attached, and someone with a detached garage should be able to have the same privilege of being able to do that. So as long as the current bulk standards were met for setbacks that are contained within the code, they felt that was appropriate. So that's what they came forward with in terms of their recommendations. Again, the key elements were to maintain residential character, to maintain some consistency with the existing residential structure on the property, both in terms of materials and roof pitch and size, and to make sure that it wasn't overly onerous in terms of setback requirements are for those structures that are less than 120 square feet.
So if you went to Sears and bought a 12 by 14 one of those metal sheds, you would have to get a permit to do that, and it would have to have the same siding as your house?
Well, under the building code, anything over 120 square feet is subject to the requirements of a building permit. That's currently in your code. It's a uniform, it's an international code that the city has adopted. So the answer is yes, today you should come to the city and get a building permit for that. Now, unfortunately, the city could not permit that metal structure because it does not meet any building code requirements. It does not meet snow load requirements. It does not meet typical construction requirements that are found in the code for structures over 120 square feet. So if you came and applied for that Sears building that was 12 by 14, we denied the permit application because it wasn't consistent with code. Now, we recognize that they are constructed, and it's one of those difficult things for building departments to deal with. Do you enforce the letter of the code, or do you allow some of those things that are pre-manufactured, pre-engineered to exist and just recognize that they're there? Those metal carports are a very similar situation. You can buy those metal carports and place them on the property as a temporary structure. And again, those don't meet code requirements, but again, they're generally considered to be temporary, so they're generally allowed. It's really a subjective issue for each city to how to deal with those. But your code very specifically is greater than 120 square feet. So this isn't changing that element. It is changing what would happen to those structures if they're over 120 square feet in terms of their requirements.
And that's the square footage of the roof?
Of the roof, not the footprint.
So you couldn't have a 10 by 12 either?
No, 10 by 10 is about the limit to okay. be under the code requirements. I mean, you can go 10.2 by whatever, but it is based on roof area.
I'm not sure that the, and I don't have an answer either, but the detached structure exceed the size of the primary dwelling. I mean, that was a given to me. It was going to be a percent.
I think this is actually one of the things that the Planning Commission had some of the most robust discussion about as to what limitation you should place on that. And I think one of the things to keep in mind is this represents all detached structures. So let's say you had a couple of the smaller sheds on your property, plus a garage. All of those would come into play in terms of their total area in relationship to the residence. But the Planning Commission did feel that 900 square feet was too small, and that basing it on the footprint of the house seemed to have merit.
Things that started all this was a citizen up on 14th and Olympia that built, and he built it all within legal code at the time, so I'm not begrudging him, but we decided that was a little much for the city, and that's why we started down this road. So what in here would have made that so we couldn't have done that?
Well, the height was probably the biggest issue on that structure.
Okay. Because I mean, that house is huge, so.
We haven't calculated the square footage in relationship to the house, but I suspect it probably was okay, but the structure wouldn't have been able to be that high.
So it might have been able to be that big, though, based on this.
Because 45% of the lot, that lot's huge, too.
Yeah, I know.
And it's an extremely large lot for a city lot.
Yes, yeah. It's probably two lots.
Well, it's over an acre, so it's more like five city lots. But you're right. That did match the building material. Mm-hmm. I believe the roof was the same. The only issue, I think, on this regulation that would have affected that construction is the overall height of the structure, which does tend to make it look extremely large in relationship to its footprint because of those really tall walls and the steepness of the roof.
But I thought the footprint was too big, too, so I was hoping there'd be some kind of equity here that we could lower that, but I'm, and maybe he's, 0.5% of the population that has that big a lot that it doesn't cover the 45%. Maybe that.
Well, and I would suggest that that's a pretty unique case in the city in terms of the size of the lot, the available land area that was there for development. You're not going to find that in most city lots of being able to build that large or that big footprint.
Isn't there already something on the books that your primary resident, including the attached garage, can't cover a certain
over a certain percent of the lot size?
There is a percentage already contained within the code.
Do you know what that is offhand?
It's 35%.
So your outbuilding could only cover 10% more if they went to the max on their primary structure?
Yes.
So that might be in 99% of the cases, the constricting factor is size of the footprint.
Yeah, unless you're dealing with a very small footprint and a two-story building, your most Rambler-style houses on a city standard city lot of 7,500 square feet are going to take, you know, a pretty large percentage of that lot. Think, you know, a 3,000 square foot house doesn't actually meet that requirement. It would have to be smaller. So that does restrict the available size of the remaining lot coverage significantly.
What's your intuitive feeling how this compares to other cities?
Well, I think it's actually a really good compromise in terms of being overly regulatory and still trying to get some handle and standards on creating a residential feel in the community. Where communities have not acted, we're beginning to see a lot of metal sided pole buildings, and some of the metal siding is either a bright white or silver, and it just simply doesn't seem to fit that character of residential neighborhoods. And so not acting, I think, will lead us down a path of having some pretty incompatible buildings for residential use. This, I think, offers a very good compromise in providing some standards, but not being overly regulatory to where people can't do some general things that they hope to do on the property.
The height, was it equal or less than the house or a certain feet? The height, what was?
The height could not exceed 18 feet or be greater than the house, whichever is less.
Okay. I like that part of it. What is a normal house? 8-foot walls and a 12-3?
Gosh, right around 11 feet.
Oh, that's all? And it can't be detached to the primary structure?
Well, it can be detached, but if it's
attached.
Well, sure. Then it becomes part of the primary structure, and we treat it as the primary structure. An attached garage is considered a portion of the primary structure.
So then you're back to the, I mean, is there a requirement that it, based on that information, I would, if I was going to add a garage then, rather than have it separate, I'd build it right up next to my house, attach it, and then I wouldn't have to mess with all this.
Other than you would probably build it in a manner that would be consistent with your structure. But it would be, in order to meet building code, you're going to have to build stick frame. You're not going to be building a full building off the end of your house. It has to meet certain building standards.
Okay.
You're probably not going to put aluminum siding, silver aluminum siding on a garage structure that's attached to your house that has lap siding. Those are just things that you don't see. I suppose if we start seeing that, you might have to react to it. But again, I think it was the effort of the Planning Commission to try not to be overly regulatory and still provide some basic standards that the community can feel meets their needs.
Have you seen that at Costco? I saw it at one time. I don't know if they carry them, but it was like a Rubbermaid garage. It was like...
Well, Costco carries two items. One is a kind of a Rubbermaid or plastic-like material shed that snaps together, and most of those are less than 120 square feet. Mm-hmm. I don't think they sell ones over 120 square feet. And then they sell a thing that is canvas, mm-hmm. and metal poles. Again, that falls into one of those temporary structures. They don't meet building code. Some communities have flat banned those. Others have just tried to coexist with those. We have no outright ban currently for those.
What comes into play when you have your primary structure, you build a unattached garage and you wish to have a covering connect them?
The breezeway is placed as part of a building permit and meets code requirements.
Okay.
Once you attach that to your house, it's required to have a permit.
But does it fall under this category then, or?
No, it would fall under residential construction.
Okay.
Any more questions? Larry, did you have any comments you wanted to say, or?
I think it was well presented.
Great.
And Councilman Spohr, I want to go back to the breezeway question because that's an important one, actually, and it comes up more often than you realize. But historically, what people have done, and I'll say historically, in the past 20 years, they built breezeways and made the claim that those two structures were now connected and that they have become one. And the code in 2006 was actually changed to say, no, you don't have two structures, you have or one structure, you have two structures, and you happen to have a cover between them. And the only time you can make that structure a single structure under code is if it's fully enclosed, a breezeway, and meets all of the code requirements, including energy code. So it literally has to be a heated, habitable space between the two structures. And that has put a pretty abrupt end to the whole idea that you can create one structure out of two by simply attaching a breezeway. So that's behind us, although we saw a lot of that just a few years ago.
Any more questions? Okay, thank you, Daryl. Where are we at here? Okay, ordinance to amend OMC chapter 6.04.020 license requirements. Daryl?
Thank you.
It's your night.
This one gets to be a bit interesting, so bear with me just a while. In the zoning code, you currently have a definition of a kennel. And a kennel, by definition, is more than two dogs, adult dogs, puppies are excluded by definition, that are on the same site. So if you have three dogs and they're adults, you have a kennel by definition in the zoning code. And it's also important to know that kennels are not allowed in any residential zone. They're only identified as an allowed use in a commercial zone, in one commercial zone and as a conditional use in another commercial zone. So if you live in a residential district and you have more than two dogs, you're currently in violation of the zoning ordinance. Now, that's in the zoning code. In another section of our code, under licensing, there's no restriction for the number of licenses that the city can sell to any particular address. And in fact, in reviewing the city records, it's clear that the city has allowed for the purchase of dog licenses for a number of households that have more than two dogs in residential zones. And in fact, there are 20 houses currently in residential zones that have three dogs. There are five houses that have four dogs. There's one house that has five dogs, and there's one house that has eight dogs. And all of those dogs have been issued licenses by the city of Wilhelmina. Now, this has led to a bit of a difficulty for our code enforcement efforts because we go knock on the door and say, gee, Mrs. Smith, how many dogs do you currently have at your residence? And Mrs. Smith says, well, I have five dogs. And she said, I have licenses for all of those five dogs, and the city of Othello has issued me those licenses. And so our code enforcement officer will stand there and go, well, yes, but that's a violation of our city code. And it creates this whole discussion of, well, it's a violation of your code, why did you sell them the license? So that has been a dilemma for our code enforcement folks to go out and try to explain to the community, on one hand, why we're selling licenses and taking the revenue, and on the other hand, why we have a code that says you can't do that. So it's important, I think, to try to create some consistency between the dog licensing code and the zoning code. So the issue before the council at some point will have to be, how do we handle this? How would you like us to handle this? We clearly have some situations in the city where we have eight dogs. It's for lack of a better term, it's a breeding kennel. No question about it. Dogs are being bred, puppies are being sold, and it clearly is a commercial operation in the residential zone. And I think it's just one that we would want to get a handle on if all the dogs were covered in license. So what we're proposing is that we change the licensing section of the code that would limit the total number of licenses that the city can sell to a number that's consistent with the zoning code. Currently, that is two. So any house, those 27 houses that we mentioned, those addresses, that have more than two dogs would currently be in violation of the zoning ordinance, and we would only be able to issue them licenses for two dogs. Now, that said, I know that I'm a dog lover. I know that in our family we have more than two dogs, and I couldn't imagine, frankly, someone coming to my door saying, which dog would you like to get rid of? That would be a very difficult task to accomplish. So we bring this to you because this is not an easy answer, and it's something that I think will probably require substantial consideration on your part to determine, one, what is the appropriate number of dogs that a resident should have in the address should have in the city, and is there a way that we can make some sort of provisions for those houses that have a reasonable number of dogs that historically have been licensed by the city? Now, those 20 houses containing three dogs, those five houses containing four. I don't know how you want to deal with those individual ones that have five or eight. It seems like they're off in a different category, but we certainly have houses that have three and four that have paid their license fees each year, and most likely are family pets. So it's a difficult situation, I think, to be in terms of how to move forward. We do need some consistency and clarity so that when we do have an extreme situation, we can take appropriate enforcement action and do it in a manner that's consistent with the code. But again, it's an issue that we'll be bringing to the council looking for direction on how you wish for us to proceed. We can modify the code however you wish, but we do think it needs to be consistent between zoning and licensing.
In my opinion on I don't know if there's where you could like grandfather those people in that have, you know, the four dogs, three dogs, four dogs. But like you say, people that have their dogs, that's like kids to some people. And I can't see us enforcing even a little 3-year-old dog away from them. I mean, I don't know how you could do that. I don't know if you could, you know, these people that we know have those dogs right now that are licensing them, you know, once their dog is gone, then, you know, they wouldn't be able to get another one to replace it. But that's my feeling.
And one of the suggestions that has come forward in this would be to set your limit at three, which would cover the vast majority of these houses that have more than two dogs. 20 that have three, and then any over that require that they be spayed or neutered, and use some sort of the attorney's not here, so I can use a grandfathering clause that will allow for them to come back in line as those dogs pass away. The difficulty I think we have is we still don't, even with that approach, we don't know how to deal with that. Those houses that are clearly being used for breeding, with five and eight dogs, it just puts them in a totally different category, and somehow we'll have to figure out how we want to address those. Because I don't think you want to grandfather in, and maybe you do, but an obvious commercial enterprise taking place in a residential district that has eight dogs, and you're actually creating quite an issue for the community, both in terms of noise and waste.
Probably odor.
Yeah. I'm trying to be polite.
Oh, okay. I guess that's what I was thinking, is that we need to raise it up to at least three, you know, so that people can have three dogs.
tough. I mean, older people especially, I don't think it's fair to love the house. Mm-hmm. I mean, because their children are gone. I know my parents have. Probably, let's count them on me to have. They love their dog.
Both oh, yeah.
are treated very well. So it's good for people that have been.
One of the things I might suggest is that you may want to hold a public hearing on the issue to see what the appropriate number of dogs and get community input. We have a reporter here this evening, and perhaps with a story that would indicate that you're discussing this issue and get some feedback from the community on what is the appropriate number might aid you in making your decision. But I suspect that those who have pets are going to come out and tell you that they should be able to keep their pets. And neighbors who are annoyed by those pets might come and say they shouldn't. So I mean, you're going to hear all those voices, but I think it's important that you have that conversation.
Is that something the council's interested in?
Yeah, I don't think it'd do any harm. At least get public input in a little bit, see what the feeling is. Looking at this, whether you say three dogs, four dogs, whatever, you can immediately stop the other portion of it by our code that says you can't do commercial business in a residence. I mean, that would take care of that portion of it.
Well, we actually thought we had that.
It, but, that's basically where it comes from.
We actually thought we had that angle under control. And as we pursued it further, the individual involved suggested that they don't do any sales or any showing of the dogs at this location, and that any of the commercial activity takes place outside of the city of Othello. And at least at this point, we did not believe our code was strong enough to be able to pursue that further. So we do need this clarification, I think, to even address that issue.
Put the fine line wholesale.
I agree, we could perhaps do that.
Is there anything we could set up online, maybe do a poll online on the city's website?
Oh, yeah.
We could work on that. I mean, well, they're not hard to do, and it takes a lot of work out. And if they mention something, then they can just jump online and even sure. maybe leave comments or.
Or can't we send something in the water bills?
Yeah, we could do that also. But I mean, a poll would be nice, because then you can at least give an option. You know, 2 or 3, you know, anything above 3, it's bigger, better, and it's, you know, kind of get a consensus of what the citizens think.
I'm not trying to complicate this any further, because it is an interesting issue, but we are at the time of year where licenses are going to start to be sold for 2011. So, we either have to take some perhaps short-term measures or clarification from the council on how to address this and resolve the issue later in the year, next year, or later January, February. Or we will have to wait an entire full year if we go through another series of sales of dog licenses as we've done in the past. We'll be saddled with this issue for another 12 months. So. We could bring back to council modifications as we presented to the code that would at least place some short-term restrictions on the sale of the licenses until we have a chance to kind of sort out what the final outcome of this might be, if that's of any interest.
Well, if we're interested, do we want to do that 3 dogs, or what are you guys thinking? I think we should do 3. That picks up that large group there. But that's how I feel about it. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Mark, yeah. You got an opinion?
We'll bring that back next week.
Okay.
Yeah, 3's okay. I'm just wondering how we accommodate the people that have historically more than that at this point.
Spayed or neutered.
Well, after 3. My thought is that it will take us several months to bring enforcement action on those homes. For the dog that they wouldn't be able to license, and for those that have 4, and the other dogs that are more. And the hope is that we would then go through a process with the council to have a final resolution of the matter January or February, and then we know a clear direction on how to deal with those circumstances.
That'd be nice to hear from the citizens and what they feel about the about it also. So
technically, if they say somebody has five dogs, their license for 2010, right? They should be able to buy a license for those five dogs in 2011. You know, so to say, grandfather class. You can't change the rules in the middle of the game for somebody.
Well, I think what we're doing though is we're stopping at three. Not that we may decide to keep going with that in the future. They still get to have their dogs. We're not taking the dogs away. What we're saying is we're going to stop at three, not let the city sell more than three licenses to an individual. And then as we look at it and as the community responds, then we decide how we're going to handle the fours, the fives, the six, and then they can come back at a later time and buy the license. Because we're going to know who the people are through their records, so, you know. Is that what we're thinking?
You know who they are
now. Well, if we have the addresses of those that have four, five, 8,000 licenses. But I think we take the approach that we sell no more than three until we sort this out, mm-hmm. and get clear direction from the council. We won't undertake enforcement action through that period when that's being determined. But if we don't sell more than three, we won't put ourselves in a box for how you want to
proceed over
the course of the next year.
That sound good to everybody?
But then what happens if one of those... You got an unlicensed dog. You're just encouraging to have unlicensed dogs.
No, it's only while we're discussing. Excuse me.
Well, it's still.
Chief's got a comment down there.
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, I have to kind of echo Councilman Spohr's thing. Now you're allowing people to violate a very clear ordinance that says every dog in the city has to be licensed. And you're allowing some not to get licenses, and you're requiring others. So now you have two standards. So I think that Councilman Garcia's point was probably better leave things the way they are until you do sort it out and then figure out what the plan is for those people that you have overextended licenses to. But I think that could get us into a position where Doyle's out there enforcing no licenses for dogs, and yet we're allowing some dogs to be unlicensed. So another problem.
Good point.
If you see anybody new that's not already in the system, then you can establish the line at three. But anybody
that seems to be a positive way to reward the people that have licensed multiple dogs in the past, reward them by allowing them to continue during this moratorium period, whatever you want to call it, but not allow any new ones with multiple dogs over three, which is a number that I've been hearing tonight. So if we'll put something together like that, if that's consistent with what you're saying.
Because it'll also allow you to cut down all the unhoused dogs right around here too. Right. Like this, you know, if you get a spayed or neutered after a certain amount, and they're not running around the neighborhood, then you don't have all these dogs that are getting thrown on the other side of the canal over there.
But if on the downside, once you license five, if they play it right, that's almost for eternity, because if one of their dogs runs away, they just get another one, and they're still come in and license five dogs. And if it's the same breed,
it would have to be the same breed in general description, because they do ask for that information.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, so it also have to be 52-year-old. I'm sorry. It would have to be the same rabies number, and the veterinarian would give it a different rabies number for a different dog. So there would be ways to do it, because rabies vaccination is a requirement.
Right, but when I go get another rabies shot for my dog, don't I get another rabies number?
Yeah, you probably do, but the rabies license should identify the age of the dog, etc. So there should be some way to tell within that paperwork.
And there will be people who will want to abuse the process.
Right.
So that's going to work.
Okay, thank you, Daryl.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ordinance amending OMC Chapter 3.02 entitled Utility, Occupation Tax, and Licensing, and Policy and Procedure. Mike?
Thank you, Mayor and Council. I'm going to be sitting down here. I have some, I know you don't have your laptops to go through this. In 2009, the State Supreme Court heard the Wayne versus City of Seattle case, which requires fire hydrant costs to be paid from the general fund because it is for general government purposes. the attached ordinance levies a 2% utility tax against the water utilities as a means of recouping the cost to the general fund associated with fire hydrant replacement and maintenance. And then there's also a city of Othello policy and procedure that's attached, and I'll go through that with you, and establishes a policy for collecting the 2% utility tax on a monthly basis. So here's the picture. The general fund has to take responsibility for the cost of fire hydrants and for the cost of maintaining those hydrants. And some cities have done some studies about how much that costs and so on. So we took a number from a city that is like the size of ours to start out with. It's about $36,000 a year. And a 2% utility tax would recoup approximately that much. So we currently do not have a utility tax against any of our city utilities, water or sewer, or of course our garbage utility. We do not have a utility tax against any of those. So this 2% would be new. It is by law, can be done by law. We can tax our utilities if we choose to do so. It's really kind of a, I'm not sure the word to use, it's just, but the water fund is ultimately ended up paying for it anyway, but it's just a way of the city taking the responsibility for paying for this and then recouping that cost through a utility tax. And then I'll show you the policy. Like this. Water system utility tax recovery to the general fund. The purpose is to establish the policy by which the general fund will recover from the water fund the first 2% of the utility tax imposed on the water system utility. Of course, this is stated assuming that you are already taxing the utility for more than that. The operation expected is the water fund, and then there's a reference to RCW that by law gives us the authority to do that. The policy, it's in the best interest of the city to collect the first 2% of the utility tax imposed on the water system utility by virtue of OMC 302060 by direct transfer from the water fund to the general fund. The procedure: on the first business day of each month, the finance director will transfer from the water fund to the general fund an amount equal to the first 2% of the utility tax imposed upon the water system. So that's basically, this is basically the policy. And then there's an ordinance attached, and it's just a change. That ordinance actually would change our OMC, self-fulfilling municipal code, to include this utility tax on our water utility at 2%. I don't know if there's any more I can say about it. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer questions.
I guess I do. So we could just have it as part of the general fund budget, not have utility tax?
Just have the fund. Should the general fund just pay for it?
That's correct.
Yes, that could be done.
I guess to me, raising 4% already, and
this would not raise. Not change the rates in the water fund.
Right.
This cost, as it's established right here, would just be borne by the water fund. Period.
Okay, so the citizens are not.
The citizens would.
Or they're not going to see a new fee on their bill.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
In other words,
okay, now I'm getting it. Okay.
The staff is not recommending a change in rates.
Okay, I don't agree with that at all. If you're adding a 2% utility tax, you're adding 2% to their bill. Just like when I get a phone bill and it's $50, 6% of that is added on. So I think we have a disconnect here.
That is an option, but that does not have to necessarily be the case. We do not have to pass this on to our ratepayers. In other words, the cost can be borne by the utility itself. In other words, right now the rates in the water fund are set to build reserves.
Right.
And we're building reserves for capital projects, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, this $36,000 would come out of that.
Well, to me, then we're playing a big, and maybe it's illegal by the state, a big shell game, because your first thing up there said fire hydrants have to come out of the general fund, so we take it out of the water fund, put it in the general fund, and now we can pay for fire hydrants.
Right. And, well,
that's exactly all, right.
It is exactly what you said, but that's exactly what they want. And I mean, the general fund could bear the entire cost, and that's an option. But our budget has gotten tighter and tighter and tighter, so that would be kind of difficult to come up with. I mean, we'd have to be.
I don't know. I mean, the purpose, it says first 2% of the utility tax imposed on the water system utility.
That's correct.
To me, that's an additional 2%.
Yeah.
Based on the precedent we've set, that all our utility taxes are an add-on. Because now you're saying that whatever we collect from the water fund, only 98% of that goes to the enterprise account for water and 2% goes to the general fund. So you're lessening the amount that's going into the water fund.
Well, I guess in truth that is true. The water fund would bear the cost of this if we wouldn't pass it on to the rate.
And I'm not sure that was the intent of this law.
What was driving this, and you've kind of centered the bullseye here, Mark, is there's a guy named Lane in Seattle. Lane sued the city of Seattle and said, I cannot be billed for fire hydrants through my utility account. And the courts agreed. City of Seattle had to reimburse thousands of residents in Seattle that portion that they had been overbilled in the water fund for so long. So back to the mayor's point, well, we can fund it directly out of the general fund. True, we could do that. But as Mike pointed out, the shortfalls in the general fund, this is just gonna add to that. So the courts have allowed a way to, as you say, play the shell game, and that's true, to circumvent the process by implementing a utility tax. And that's all it is. You're exactly right. You see right through it. Exactly what's going on.
These are actually costs that have been borne by the water fund all along.
Right.
So it isn't like this is a new thing for the water
fund. We've used our water fund to buy, I thought hydrants, yes, came out of the general fund.
No. Before this, no. They weren't doing that.
They've always been bought out of the water fund, but the courts have now said they have to be out of the general fund.
And this has to be in place by January 1st, and the auditor is going to audit to make sure this is
a case of
your farm. It's just kind of a, I don't know, it's just kind of a, I feel just like you do, it's like a shell game.
Mike, one question here, I guess, talking about this 2% plan back and forth, however you do that,
yeah,
you could also do the other thing, not saying no because we've already raised by 4%, but you can still go ahead and use that through the citizens for an additional increase, right? By using that through that tax portion. Not this, I'm not saying that, yeah, now, but
right.
But if down the road we say, okay, we're going to change ours, we're not going to raise it, we're going to add a tax to it, then we could do that either way. There's an option both ways, right?
Sure. When we look at rates at a utility, we look at the cost of operating a utility, number one. We look at our capital facilities plan. What is the future? What does the next 6 years look like in terms of capital, et cetera? So all of this is thrown into that mix. And so if we say, well, the water fund is paying 2%, 2% utility tax to the general fund. That's their cost of doing operations. So how do we structure our rates to take all that into consideration? So that would be true. But it doesn't have to specifically be billed out to rate payers.
So we could take our 4% we're talking, say 2% increase and 2% tax, and be the same then across the board. So if we take care of that problem, we would be shoveling that money back.
Except the predication of the 4%, as Mike started with, is based on the operational cost of the system. If we hadn't set that on the front end for that, that would make some sense.
There, the other piece of the puzzle, though, is part of what we collect on the enterprise fund for the water, a portion of that, somewhat subjectively, the amount, goes to the general fund already.
We do have a general fund allocation.
Yeah, and that's to pay for the building that supposedly goes toward water and the workers, that the resources that go toward water, so.
What we call overhead.
Right, and I don't know, it seemed like when we established that rate, we had a little bit of flexibility in that, exactly what that amount was.
I think you did, you're right.
And so, and I don't know what it is right now, but. And I believe, another comment, as I believe some of our neighbors to the south and maybe around us, but they actually charge up to 6% utility tax on their water and sewer and garbage, which we do not do.
That's correct.
That's correct. They're
yeah, as an additional amount.
For instance, to consider taking this amount and say, let's say, increasing the cost allocation from the general fund, well, then it's almost like a gifting from a utility to a general operating fund, which is against the law. And if it isn't truly part of the real cost allocation. So this is a legal way of getting money from the utility without
That was my definition. This was gifting.
So it still gives us legally gives us the right to do it.
But we have to bring this back next week in order to get it on the books by the first of the year. As Mike said, we're going to be audited, so we can do it. There's been a couple suggestions on how you want it brought back to you.
You know, once in a while I refer to the big umbrella theory. It's you can take property taxes and what you pay for water, you know, it's all taxes of what it costs me and what goes to the city. And so we're taking a relatively small amount out of water that used to buy fire hydrants and moving that to general fund to buy fire hydrants. To me, it doesn't make a hill of beans difference.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, if I guess that's what we got to do to keep the auditors happy. I don't care.
So you're saying, Mike, this would be the cleanest way to get the money into the general fund?
And it is being used by other cities. In other words, there is a kind of a standard being established in this
act. Now, here's a question, though. That 2% that comes over from the water fund, does that have to go into an earmarked account that's only for fire hydrants?
Yes. That's one of the things I was going to bring up, and I forgot to. I said, because this is new, that we can track the cost and we can adjust that utility tax to match the cost. So if the costs come in lower than that, we look at that our first year of operating, and then we can come back to council and make a recommendation that we lower that 2% to whatever it takes to cover it.
So it's almost a separate reserve that we've got this reserve now for fire hydrants. And you have to keep track of how much goes in there, and then when you buy a fire hydrant, you take it out of there and see what the balance is at the end of the year. But that's just more accounting trouble for you.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't buy the same number.
Right, year. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Interesting.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay, do we have any committee reports? Okay, unfinished business? New business. I had something I'd like to have everybody think about. Right now, off and on, we have times when we need to meet with other agencies, in particular the school. The school board meets like we do on Mondays. So it's difficult to go either direction if we need to visit with them or if they need to their board or if they need to visit to us. Maybe you guys might want to think about, or maybe have a better idea, is maybe having our workshops on Tuesday. One meeting a month, our workshop. We do it on Tuesday nights. That way, if we need the school, they can be here. If we need to be at theirs, somebody can go on Monday. You know, I don't know, something. Is there something going on Tuesdays? Anybody knows that?
School board meets on the second and fourth Monday of the month.
Oh, so the first Monday wouldn't help.
So it would make a difference.
Okay, so that won't make a difference. Okay.
You know, the school board, the school district violated our easement, so as part of that easement, let's make them meet on Tuesday.
Well, there's a reason they can't.
Yeah. Yeah, I visited with George. They can't because their sports and other things are on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and of course, Wednesday's church in this town. And so those days do not work for them. So, you know, I was trying to think if there's a way that we could somehow reach out and be available for each other. Maybe us as a council could, you know, do something. But I did not realize they did not meet like we do. So anyhow. So they meet on the 2nd and the 4th.
And we have
2nd, 4th.
Our off meeting is the 3rd Sunday, Monday, so we don't cross up there either.
Yeah. Tim?
Couldn't they come on the 1st then? Could they meet 2nd and 4th? Couldn't they come on the 1st? Come to your meeting on the 1st.
For the workshop.
Yeah. Yeah, we can't make any decisions, but... Yeah. I guess we'll think about
it. We can go to theirs, though, because they don't meet then.
We can go to theirs?
They don't meet on the 1st.
Oh.
So we couldn't go to theirs.
Yeah.
You'd have to change our 2nd.
Well, I'll think about it, if that's something we need to do or not. I don't know. Just trying to figure out a way to draw the two entities together more so that we can meet and listen to each other, know what each other's doing, and, you know, be more on top of helping each other. So, but think about it. Okay. Any other new business? Okay, mayor's announcements. The regional mayor's luncheon, which is for the county, will be this Wednesday, December 8th at noon at the Othello Senior Center. I will not be able to make this one. I'll be out of town, so I don't know if there's anybody that's able to possibly go. Try to be there if you can. Thursday, December 9th at 9:30 will be a Public Works Labor Negotiations Negotiations. So council members Darrow, Deaver, and Kaler. So I think you're all aware of that. Shop with a Cop is this Saturday, December 11th. Gift wrapping to be done in the chamber from 1 to 5. The schools have provided the police department with the names of 10 children who have been chosen to participate. There will be a pizza lunch, after which the children will be driven in police cars with lights and sirens to Walmart, where they will shop using a gift card they received to buy their families Christmas gifts, which is great. After shopping, the gifts are brought to the City Hall, where volunteers from the high school and City Hall wrap the gifts, and then more volunteers would be appreciated. So if there's any volunteers, we could use some more. And number 5, Christmas will be observed by closing City Hall on Friday, December 24th, as well as New Year's on Friday, December 31st. And this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Any thoughts on the school thing? Let me know.
You know, not about it.
We feel like it's important
for 4 years and haven't figured it out.
Well, do we change?
It's a valid point. You know, I'd like to go to a school board meeting.
So would I.
Well, sometimes if they finished early here at 7:30, I'd rip down there. But
I'd like to go myself. So maybe want to think about doing a Tuesday, the 2nd or the 4th, which makes it difficult then for people.
Right. It's not consistent.
It's
here.
Not consistent. So I don't know what the answer is. But. Oh, yeah.